We were really undercounted 10 years ago.
The Census Bureau makes an effort to get an accurate count in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 21st of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new film that tells the story of Alaska Natives' struggle for civil rights in the state.
That's my kind of story, is when people who dare to go up and speak truth to power, and I thought, oh, this is a film.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is November 2nd. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association.
The head of the Justice Department's anti-corruption unit is stepping down after the office's botched trial of former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. The Public Integrity Unit has been under intense scrutiny since the guilty verdict against Stevens, an Alaska Republican, was thrown out due to key evidence being withheld from his defense. William Welch's departure is a mutual decision, says Welch's boss, Lanny Brewer. Welch plans to remain a federal prosecutor but will relocate to Massachusetts. Brewer also praised Welch as an extraordinary person. All but one of the other five prosecutors who worked on the Stevens case have already taken other positions, and there are two separate investigations into how the case was handled. The state of Alaska has lost another attempt to overturn a decision that favors Alaska tribes in child welfare proceedings, such as taking children into protective custody, placement in foster homes, and adoptions. The case was brought by the village of Kaltag for adoptive parents who asked the state to issue a new birth certificate for their adopted child, listing them as the parents. Native American Rights Fund attorney Heather Kendall Miller says the state refused, stating they would not recognize tribal court adoption proceedings.
So the case was litigated through federal court. Judge Burgess upheld the tribe's claim at the district court level. The case was then vigorously appealed before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and a unanimous panel last fall affirmed the district court's holding that tribes in Alaska do have jurisdiction over adoptions and directed the state to give full faith and credit to such adoption decrees.
The debate stems from a decision made during the Murkowski administration. Murkowski accepted an opinion written by Attorney General Greg Rehnquist that stated tribes do not possess inherent jurisdiction over their children. Until that time, the state issued 50 to 60 new birth certificates per year for tribal court adoptions, but abruptly quit the practice after the Rehnquist opinion was put in place. The state then contended that tribal court rulings would only be recognized in cases where a state court had transferred the case to tribal court through the Indian Child Welfare Act, or if a tribe had petitioned for tribal court jurisdiction under ICWA. The Ninth Circuit panel was unanimous in their initial rejection of the state's challenge. In this month's decision, the Ninth Circuit refused the state's request for an en banc or full court hearing of their case. There is clear legal precedent for tribal court authority in child welfare cases in lower 48 reservation communities.
So the state has lost at every step of the way in attempting to get the federal court to accept its very limited interpretation of tribal jurisdiction in Alaska.
Kendall Miller says the federal courts have been very clear that tribes here do have child welfare case jurisdiction, and they need to come forward if the state does not give those decisions full credit, because the federal courts are there to enforce tribal rights.
So the state knows that if it's going to continue to deny recognition of tribal court adoption decrees, that it will be subject to being brought back into federal court and paying attorney's fees and all that kind of thing, because it's an issue of law that's been decided.
Kendall Miller says although this decision relates to the Kaltag case, it's an issue of law that has much broader implications. State Law Department spokesman Bill McAllister says the state is still reviewing the decision and has not yet decided if an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court will be mounted. U.S. Census officials are in Anchorage today in intensive training sessions with partnership specialists. The specialists will be on the front lines of collecting census data in Alaska villages, and as APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports, they will be doing a thorough job come January.
That's right. In January of 2010, census gatherers will get started in Alaska. In every other state, the census starts in April. But as regional census official Ruben Del Valle tells us,
it will start earlier by 3 months, January 25th. The reason being is that if we start in the same time, well, by that time, most of the villagers in Alaska would have been gone, doing their fishing and things that they do for a living. So before the ice breaks up, we would like to do our enumeration or census in Alaska.
So census takers are paying careful attention to Alaska villages this year. Why? Barbara Fleek is a team leader for partnership specialists in Alaska.
It's important because we were really undercounted 10 years ago. And so the Census Bureau, really has put the focus on local hire in our villages and communities because that will increase the return rate for the questionnaire.
Fleek says every person truly does count. Census figures are used to determine federal and state funding for schools, health clinics, and other vital community services.
This time around, we're doing far more outreach, and we're working more closely with the local census office staff because we want success in every arena that there is, including employment. And that's one of the things, too, is recruitment for local hire in local communities and the villages.
A conference in Anchorage for census workers on Wednesday aimed at mobilizing village tribal leaders to equip them with the knowledge of where to get started. Fleek says that partnership assistants have been hired from villages through village corporations.
Another focus, what I've heard from the villages I've been to, bilingual. Because, of course, the areas that I cover, I mean, from the little tiny kids in Head Start, you know, to the elders, they're bilingual. You know, their first language is Yupik. And so we definitely want to hire local there because access is going to be easier.
Fleek encourages everybody in the state to be counted. There's only 10 questions on the census form, she says, and it only takes 10 minutes to answer them. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, telling the unique stories of Unalaska.
I come squishing in the house, and Karen looked at me and she says, "Where have you been?" And I says, "Well, I got attacked by an eagle."
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
This week, a film about Alaska civil rights will make its state debut at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Anchorage. For The Rights of All, Ending Jim Crow in Alaska is a one-hour documentary profiling the struggle for Alaska Native rights. The film had its very first public screening recently in Washington, D.C., at a venue the producers say was particularly meaningful. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Well, this is a very special evening for me. It took 4.5 years, 5 years almost, to make this film, and to finally be arrived at this moment is pretty exciting.
Director Jeffrey Silverman spoke these words in a darkened auditorium in Washington on the evening of his film's debut.
You could call this the world premiere, yeah.
On a warm September night a few weeks ago, Silverman waited to show his film to crowds gathered at the National Museum of the American Indian, part of the Smithsonian. The film chronicles Alaska Natives' fight for equality.
This is their story. The Alaska Natives' nonviolent struggle against racism. 2 decades before the national civil rights movement of the 1960s, Alaska Natives empowered themselves and enriched us all.
Silverman is not himself Alaska Native, but was captivated by the story of Elizabeth Paratrovich, the civil rights leader who spoke out at a hearing of the territorial legislature and helped convince them to pass the Anti-Discrimination Act in 1945. Silverman says her story and that of other Alaskans is worth sharing.
They were up against the established order, and the order was Jim Crow, segregation, don't mess with the way things are. And that's my kind of story, is when people who dare to go up and speak truth to power, and I thought, oh, this is a film.
Silverman first produced a 3-minute short film about Paratrovich and then set to work turning it into something much, much bigger. His new film includes other Alaskans who contributed to the civil rights struggle, like Alberta Schenck, an Inupiat who refused to leave the whites-only section of a Nome movie theater, and Tlingit William Paul Sr., who fought for voters' rights and was Alaska's first Native attorney and legislator.
One of Paul's first cases involved his mother, Tilly Paul Tamari, who was arrested for encouraging a Native man to vote in the 1922 election.
Director Jeffrey Silverman worked with Diane Benson on the project. She created a popular one-woman play about Paratrovich and reprised the role in the film, in which she plays her fellow Tlingit Raven.
This is everybody's story, and Alaska was the first to pass that kind of anti-discrimination bill. Remarkable achievement. And civil rights issues are always going to be issues, but hopefully we can make those issues so much smaller. But we're not going to make that the need for civil rights and the fight for civil rights different unless we remember our history.
Benson says the highlight of her role comes when Elizabeth Paratrovich delivers her impassioned speech for civil rights.
When my husband and I moved to Juneau, we sought a home in a nice neighborhood where our children could play happily with our neighbors' children. And we found such a house and had arranged to lease it. But when the owners learned that we were Indian, they said no. Would we be compelled to live in the slums? Even now, there are doors to schools closed to our children, and signs make it quite clear that I, as well as dogs, are not allowed in certain establishments.
Benson says seeing the film debut at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian shows how far the fight for equality has come. Museum Associate Director Maggie Burton says showing the film was a natural fit.
It's very important for this museum to bring Alaska into the fold and to make people in Washington and Nebraska and Alabama know that there's a story up north as well.
Director Jeffrey Silverman agrees that the venue resonates, especially before an audience of Washington policymakers. A handful of senators watched the film, and dozens of congressional staffers did too.
I don't think that anyone would have imagined back then that it would be playing here at the museum on the mall in the Smithsonian at the National Museum of the American Indian. You know, who could have foreseen that? I'm just honored to be part of it and just so pleased that it's on this stage here. It's the most appropriate. And in Alaska, to me, the appropriate venue for the Alaska premiere is going to be at AFN Convention.
For the Rights of All, Ending Jim Crow in Alaska, plays at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention on Thursday. Next month, it will air on public television throughout the country. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
A new online video and audio archive highlights stories of Unalaska's history. KUCB's Ann Hillman has the story.
University of Alaska Fairbanks recently created an online database from the Unalaska Communities of Memory Project. The stories and video were gathered from people around the Aleutians back in 1996. William Schneider is a curator of oral history at UAF and has worked with the statewide story project since it began.
The goal in each community was to look at a sense of place and using stories as a way to get at how people define the importance of where they live.
Schneider says stories were gathered in digital format around the state, then languished without being shared with the public because the project ran out of funding. Now, with a grant from the Alaska Humanities Forum, 13 of the stories from Unalaska are now available on the Communities of Memory Project Jukebox website. You can watch videos, read transcriptions, and see old images from the project. Former resident Ray Hudson helped coordinate the original storytelling session and helped choose which stories would appear on the website.
I think it's a chance for new community members to learn something about the place they're now at, and it's something for long-time residents to go to and to sort of renew memories of what things were like previously. And all of that's, I think, helpful when people are making decisions at the present time.
The stories range from humorous accounts of eagle attacks by Bob Allen.
Deck boots on there all full of water. I come squishing in the house, and Karen looked at me, and she says, "Where have you been?" And I says, "Well, I got attacked by an eagle." And I told her an eagle had grabbed a hold of me, and she says, "Where?" And I pulled down my pants, and I says, "There."
To Rafina Shishnikov's startling memories of the effects of the Amchitka nuclear testing.
I went to work at the clinic that year in November after the blast, and that year later on, there were, I remember, 13 miscarriages on Alaska that year after the blast. People began to get bald spots in their heads.
Cora Holmes remembers coming into Unalaska for a memorial service that day. She ended up telling ghost stories about Chernofsky Ranch, where she lived alone with her husband and occasional workers on the far side of the island. She said you could feel the presence of the people who lived there back when it was an Aleut village, before the Russians came.
Whenever you were alone out there, there was a different sense about what was there before. I honestly could feel different presences at different spots.
She told the story of a ghost weaving on her loom one night when she was there alone. Ray Hudson reflected on the ghosts of World War II and talked about Henry Swanson, a local legend. Stories ranged in history from the early 1900s, when children attended Russian school, to the 1990s, when the World War II cabanas were removed from Ski Bowl and the roads were paved. Project Jukebox research technician Marla Statswich says the website also contains historical footage from around the Aleutians that isn't properly identified.
We'd love it if people would tell us, "Oh, that's so-and-so," or "That's my grandmother," or because a lot of the material we have has no connection, no names of the people.
You can see all of the footage, listen to all of the stories, and contact the project coordinators through their website. For KUCB, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business, and by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future.
Yakutat could be done with its pike problem. The state poisoned the ravenous invasive species out of some small lakes near the northern southeast Alaska town. And the salmon that once lived there have started to return. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Gordy Woods knew something was different when terns and seagulls started hanging out in some ponds near Yakutat.
I thought to myself, I've never seen birds in those ponds, and it came to me in years past when they landed in there, they got their little webbed feet bitten, and now they are not getting bitten, and so they are using those ponds to for wash tubs, you know, that sort of thing.
The fish and game commercial biologist knew the ponds had been home to northern pike for more than 40 years, and he knew that pike were voracious eaters, devouring other fish in the lakes. The pike were put in the ponds by people who thought they'd be fun to catch. But that was in a time when officials took a different approach to sport fishing.
In the 1960s, nobody was thinking in terms of invasive species. But when you go around putting northern pike into ponds that had the potential to have salmon in them, then what you were doing was, in fact, introducing an invasive species.
Fish and Game spent a fair amount of time considering the options. They decided to use a chemical called rotenone that's routinely applied to kill exotic fish so local species can regain their natural habitat. Yakutat sport fisheries biologist Brian Marston ran the eradication effort.
Rotenone inhibits oxygen transfer in oxygen-breathing animals with gills. So the oxygen is deprived from the animal intracellularly. It doesn't take oxygen out of the water. What it does, it just inhibits anything that has gills from getting oxygen, so they asphyxiate themselves.
The chemical was applied to the dozen or so ponds last winter and spring. So far, Marston says he's seen no indication any pike survived, and he's even watched some coho salmon returning to the waterways. Meanwhile, people in Yakutat can still fish for pike. There's a natural, non-invasive population in a larger lake system about 20 miles out of town.
The theory is, anyway, the pike were left from prior to the last ice age, so that the pike may have been more widespread prior to the last ice age, and those were just left because there was a little bit of available habitat.
Similar populations of pike can be found farther north. The natural population is an important sport and subsistence fish north of the Alaska Range, and there's invasive populations in part of south-central Alaska that have decimated juvenile salmon, trout, and other naturally occurring fish. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Sitka.
A delegation from Sitka traveled last week to Dubuque, Iowa. They were meeting with University of Dubuque officials who have expressed interest in the Sheldon Jackson College campus. Both sides say the trip went well. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
In the courtship between Sitka and Dubuque University, the recent visit by the Sitka delegation to Dubuque was a pretty good second date. And now both sides say they're hopeful they can build something lasting. Here's what Dubuque University President Jeffrey Bullock has to say.
Yeah, I'd say we're still on the way to real positive happenings and working towards a positive relationship.
And here's how Sitka Mayor Scott McAdams sees it.
I'm hopeful, in fact, I'm confident that there will be a good outcome of these meetings.
Joining McAdams on the trip to Dubuque were City Administrator Jim Dinley, Economic Development Association Director Gary White, and David Dobler, the president of Sheldon Jackson College. They held meetings and took a tour of the campus. The next step, McAdams says, is to keep holding discussions and for Dubuque to decide what it wants to do.
Before they move forward and actually lay out an action plan, it's going to be well vetted. It's going to be viable. But when they're in, they're in.
Bullock says his university wants to make sure that any partnership it builds with SJ will last.
Education is an extremely, extremely challenging competitive environment. And what we're trying to figure out is what that plan looks like so that we can compete at the highest level and be successful doing that.
Bullock says he got the sense that the Sitka delegation and his team were on the same page regarding a partnership.
What was very important for us about this meeting was to see that your representatives from Sitka were committed to this endeavor, and we understand clearly that if this is going to work, it's going to have to be a partnership, and it's going to have to be a collaboration in more than just words. And we really sense that, and I think they sense that as well.
McAdams says whatever happens will take a little time, but that the patience could lead to something worthwhile and lasting.
You know, I know that there are some people in the community that may like or wish that two meetings would unto itself render a deal for the next 100 years, but so it's a little bit more complex than that. It's going to take some time. So to be able to specifically pin down on what the food service hours will be at 7 o'clock on Tuesday right now is not what this meeting was about. This was about us having a dialogue about who we are, what we aspire to be as a community.
The trip to Dubuque took place October 12th through the 14th and follows a visit from a Dubuque delegation in August. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Anchorage's Clark Middle School will soon have a student health clinic. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
School board member Kathleen Plunkett lives in the Clark Middle School area of Northeast Anchorage.
I can attest to the community's need for that. When the health center left Mountain View, the void that left for our students.
A sizable portion of Clark's slightly over 1,000 students come from economically disadvantaged families. Basic health care, and often the transportation to get to crosstown clinics, is a challenge. At a Monday morning press conference held at the school, Superintendent Carol Como said the in-school clinic idea came up during the planning stage of the new school that finally opened this fall.
One of the things that came out loud and clear from the community was some place where their kids could get some immunizations or some school physicals type of things.
That concern resulted in a yet unused room adjacent to the school nurse's office. Clark Principal Cecily Williams enthusiastically supports the clinic.
We would send students home, and there may not be the funds or the resources to be able to have those small things taken care of. When if we had someone here, we could keep them in school, attendance is better, our students are healthy, our parents have resources, and why not one stop where you can come here? And overwhelmingly, that was a yes by parents, a yes by community, and definitely a yes by the staff and the administrative team that was here.
Teresa O'Connor from Anchorage's Department of Health and Human Services agreed with Williams.
Research from the thousands of other school health centers that exist across the country show that health outcomes and school outcomes are better when services are provided to students on site.
Como told the school board that as part of the year-and-a-half-long pilot program, the district would closely evaluate the clinic to see if it did indeed improve attendance and academic achievement. The clinic, which is tentatively scheduled to open in January, would begin by offering only sports physicals. Parental permission is mandatory. Only Clark students, no siblings or adult family members, could use the clinic. No school district personnel would be directly involved in the clinic. An amendment by board member Crystal Kennedy made community collaboration a must, a position supported by Superintendent Como. Funding, whether contributions or grants, must come from outside the school district budget. And as Nancy Edel, director of the district's nursing and health services, repeatedly noted,
if you want a successful school-based health center, you must ask the community what they want. If we go in and we say, we think you have a lot of suicidal kids and we're going to offer behavioral health services, we're not going to get anywhere. We need the community to want that. We need the kids to ask for it. We need the parents to ask for it.
Behavioral health is a possible expansion service. The only other such school clinic in the state is in Juneau. According to Edel, about 65% of all visits there have a behavioral component. Other possible expansion areas include immunizations, nutritional counseling, and acute care for minor illnesses and injuries. Again, these additional services would occur only if the community wanted them and the resources found to support them. Jeff Friedman's pre-vote comment reflected the basis for the board's unanimous approval.
I do not believe that schools can provide everything to a community or to students or children within a community, but I do believe we have a vital role in facilitating other groups like this one to provide those services.
The commitment of other groups was shown in an email sent Monday afternoon from the CEO of Providence Alaska Medical Center, Dick Monsager, to Como. It said that Providence intends to give the district a minimum of $25,000 annually for at least 3 years in support of in-school clinics. This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey and Ellen Lockyer reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, fight the flu by washing your hands often or using a hand sanitizer, coughing into your sleeve or a tissue, and keeping sick people at home. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.